Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I am Pam Gates, one of the members. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age, your abilities, or inabilities. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, as today, or by the minister. The opening words will be read by Molly.
This is titled Commitment. People say, "What is the sense of our small effort?" They cannot see that we must lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. A pebble cast into a pond causes ripples that spread in all directions. Each one of our thoughts, words, and deeds is like that. No one has a right to sit down and feel hopeless. There is too much work to do. Dorothy Day.
And now Leah and Isabel will do the chalice lighting.
May the earth only good and useful fires burn. May the flames be not the source of destruction, but a friend. May the light of this flame remind us the path of peace and wisdom.
Now, I'm going to introduce our speakers. Start with Frank Davis, whom I've had the privilege of knowing for only a few months. He's a committed family man and a dynamo of a community organizer. He's doing a whale of a job helping Moses, the local affiliate of the statewide human rights organization Wisdom, get more effective in its efforts to change Wisconsin's mass incarceration policies. And as most of you know, Prairie is a member of Moses. I've known James Morgan since October of 2011, when I met him at the first public meeting of Moses, which was a forum on Ban the Box. Perhaps they'll mention that today, I'm not sure. James is one of the founders of Moses. He's also a 2013 grad of the Odyssey Project, the same year as my granddaughter. He's an artist, he's a writer, and he is a tireless speaker on the injustices of our criminal justice system. And Liza Monroe is a member of First Unitarian, another tireless worker for Moses Concerns, and the three of them have put together, well, I think it's more than three, it's the Moses committee at First, have put together a fine presentation that Molly Plunkett signed us up for as soon as she found out about it. So let us welcome our guests. Well, we're all very glad to be with you this morning. Frank Davis and James Morgan will be helping with the question and answer. I'm going to take us through the PowerPoint. I did want to mention that the PowerPoint we have is an adaptation of one that was quite a bit longer that Wisdom put together, and First Unitarian shortened it, pulled out certain slides. However, it was developed about 3.5 years ago, or 2.5. And since then, there's been a lot of research done on revocations, because there was a study group that recently put out a report on the health impacts of crimeless revocations on individuals and their families. And they have gathered up a lot of very current data. So there's data in here that is somewhat out of date, so I'm going to try to correct it as we go. And your handouts also are a little out of date. I couldn't help but think that when the choir sang their song, How Long, that would be the refrain that we in Moses and we in Wisdom feel about the revocation system and how long it's going to take to make some changes. So we can Pam mentioned that what Moses is, you're a part of Moses, so we'll just move to the next slide. And the next slide after that. And our goal this morning is to kind of define it and talk about some of the problems with it and then some of the solutions to it. Next slide. What I'd like to do is to start with a little bit of background. You can see that over the past three decades, there's been a big increase in the population in prison. This goes from 1980 up to 2011. And up until the mid-90s, it was kind of steady, you know, around 5,000. Then it started really growing in the mid-90s, and by 2002, Wisconsin had hit about 22,000 people in prison. And since then, it's been fairly steady. And even taking into account the overall growth of Wisconsin's population during those years, the rate of incarceration has grown fourfold since the 80s. And both Democratic and Republican administrations in our state government are responsible for this increase. It's not just one party. Okay, next. Wisconsin has terrible racial disparities when we look at the incarcerated population. This shows the 10 worst states in the country. And among the states, Wisconsin has a shameful distinction of being the worst in terms of incarcerating black men. About 12.8% of all black men in Wisconsin are either in prison or in jail. And this is almost twice the national average, which is about 6.7%. Also, black men are extremely overrepresented based on their numbers in the state. African-American males make up about 6.5% of our population, but they represent almost 40% of the people that are in prison. Okay. So what do we mean by revocation? A revocation occurs when the Department of Corrections, DOC, puts a person back in prison who has been out in the community under supervision by a parole or a community agent, either for committing a new crime or for violating a rule of supervision, but not a new crime. Wisdom calls this crimeless revocations. The DOC calls it revocation only. Either way, no new crime. We see that crimeless revocation has a big impact on the number of people that are in prison. This graph shows who was sent to prison annually from the years 2000 to 2013. The graph is from the DOC and that uses their terminology. The three lines represent different categories of people that were sent to prison. The bottom line are people who had previously been in prison, were released, but were sent back because they committed a new crime. And in the year 2013, that was a little over 1,000 people. The middle line mainly represents people who committed a crime. They hadn't previously been in prison. It's a bit of an overgeneralization, but I don't need to go into the details. But these new sentence only people total a little over 2,600 in the year 2013. What we want to do is to focus on the top line, which represents the people sent back because they broke a rule of supervision. And that was about a little over 4,000 in the year 2013. So if we add up those numbers on the far right, we get about 7,700 people. And the crimeless revocation group numbers is the highest, of course. And it represents slightly more than half of the prison population that year. And over the years, we have seen that this consistently does represent the largest number of people going back. The statistics are roughly 40% of the group. It's always these folks. Now, I want to mention, this is where we get a little bit into our dated information here. DOC is starting to really track very carefully some of these groups. And we're finding that although there are still about 4,000 people sent back every year, it appears that that are revoked. It appears that about 1,000 of those eventually by the courts are deemed guilty of committing a new crime. So it looks like, but that happens after they've already been sent back. Before that was figured out, they were just taken off. And so what it seems as though we're seeing, and Wisdom is using this figure now, it's roughly 3,000 people a year that we can clearly identify as being sent back just for breaking the rules. We want to look at some of the problems that we're running into with revocation. As I mentioned, there are large racial disparities. In fact, crimeless revocation is the main reason that black people are sent back to prison. And in the last 15 years, almost half of all black individuals were there were not committed of new crimes. They had just broken rules of supervision. Okay? Another problem concerns these rules of supervision. And again, I have to start with a change in that first figure, the 25 to 55. The DOC figured out, finally, that the numbers of rules that they were subjecting people to were extremely burdensome. And they went back through them all and pulled some of them out. So instead of being the 25 to 55, we're now down to 18 to 34. There's 23, I think it's around 18 to 23, but if a person is convicted of being a sexual offender, then they add on a bunch and they're up to 34. There's a standard set of rules for everybody, and then there are rules that are designed for the individual themselves. Violations of these rules, see some of these, using a computer or cell phone without permission, missing, I love this one, a scheduled or unscheduled appointment. Must be an impromptu meeting. Borrowing money without approval, crossing county lines without permission, buying, selling, or driving a car without written permission. And many people have commented on how difficult it is to live one's life being sure that you're following every single rule. And in fact, a former secretary of the DOC, I think it was in the 1980s, Walter Dickey, had commented that if he had been under supervision, he didn't think he would have been able to maintain every single rule and that he probably would have been revoked himself. What are some of the costs of crimeless revocations? There is a devastating cost in terms of the human cost to the individual, to their family, especially children in the household. That usually leads to job loss. That often creates disruption in the housing. So there's this gigantic ripple effect. This leads to crowded prison conditions that lead to stress both on prisoners and on the prison guards. Studies have shown that revoking large numbers of people generally does not improve public safety. And the tax dollars are extremely high. The $150 million breaks down to about $38,000 per prisoner every year. There are also inconsistencies in terms of how the DOC agents deal with the rules. If there are violations, some will recommend alternatives to incarceration, and others will recommend prison. And we have an example here of a Wisdom member who was arrested on a charge of disorderly conduct, thereby violating rule supervision. And there were two differing opposing recommendations on what should be done. One of the agents felt that because this agent had some training in mental health issues, he had recommended an alternate to going back to prison. The second agent, who did not have this kind of training, felt that a return to prison was appropriate. The person requested a hearing before a judge, and while this conflict was being sorted out, he finally got his hearing. He was sat in jail for 6 months before he could get to see a judge. When he got to that person, the judge didn't deem his behavior as disorderly conduct and dismissed the case entirely. And meanwhile, his life had been disrupted for half a year. Another problem has to do with limited due process around this whole system. It's a very convoluted process, and a person does not have the typical legal rights of an ordinary citizen. Decisions about revocation are based on a preponderance of evidence, and that is a lower standard than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. There are no rights to bail and no access to the circuit court or to a judge or jury. The reason for this, the basic concept, is that because a person is still under DOC's jurisdiction and they have their own rules and procedures which prevail. And to many of us in Moses and Wisdom, this seems more like a Kafkaesque world where they have way too much power and way too little accountability. Other examples of limited due process, it doesn't take much to cause an arrest. A person in the community who has some kind of complaint can call up, and usually the person will be arrested. And if a parole agent does recommend revocation, and the individual wants to challenge that, they could sit in jail 3 months or more before they can get a hearing. And we've seen that happen to members of Moses. And the person, when the person does finally get their hearing, there isn't any community oversight. It's not part of the judicial branch. The administrative law judges are usually employees of the State Department of Administration, and they tend to pretty much support the recommendations of the agents. So, what are some of the things, what are some of the things that we can suggest as solutions? And some of these are on your handout. One of Wisdom's ideas is to create what's called community revocation panels, giving the control back to the community. So our Wisdom's idea is, well, let's revoke the power of DOC to imprison people for breaking rules. So these panels would be made up of judges, social workers, people that have training in mental health issues, drug and alcohol counselors, and some community members. These would be the people that would make decisions. And since the DOC, especially with the people that they want to send back to prison, feel that they are a safety risk to the community, we want to have DOC make their case to these community panels. So first off, they would have to explain why the person, based on their violations, should be actually sent back to prison. They would have to show what other kinds of alternative sanctions were tried first. They would need to show why the person is really a threat. And they would need to explain the reasons for the length of sentence that they want to impose when they send the person back. And after presenting their case, then the DOC would have to wait for the panel to make its deliberations and either accept or reject what DOC is recommending. Another benefit of this kind of an approach has to do with the emotional and the psychological impact of this process. The current system generates a great deal of bitterness and anger for the individual and for their families. The person is suddenly picked up, off, disappears for a while, no one knows exactly what's happened until they can let somebody know. They may send up, they always end up sitting in jail a certain period of time, and especially longer if they're waiting for a hearing. Once a decision is made to revoke, this is often seen and felt by the individual and their family as very unfair, very arbitrary, and unjust. If we had more people involved in the decision, including community members, it's likely that the people involved would feel that there was community oversight and there would be fairness injected into the process. And that's likely to lead to safer and healthier and more just communities. Probably almost a year ago, in Milwaukee, Moses' counterpart, MICA, along with their local NAACP chapter, had tried to get together to propose some legislation so that a community revocations panel pilot program could be started, but that never went anywhere. Okay, next. Another suggestion is to hire more social workers as agents in the system. Before the super tough on crime era came, and before the truth in sentencing law went into effect, which was in the year 2000, there were more agents in the system that did have social work backgrounds. And these folks were less likely to send people back to prison for breaking rules. The agents were focused more on a rehabilitation approach, than on a punitive approach. In the past, more agents stayed in the corrections field. They were therefore older and more experienced, and they were willing to take some risks on individuals. Nowadays, the agents tend to be younger, they tend to be less well-trained, and they're pretty leery of taking many risks. We heard of one person who is now retired who was an agent in the system, and she had a social work background, and she said that she had never needed to revoke a prisoner. Another suggestion is that there is a short-term sanctions law that was passed by the Wisconsin State Legislature in the year 2014. And the intention of it was to get DOC to develop alternative sanctions to imprisonment. The idea was a graduated set of sanctions from low to medium to high, depending on the violations and the numbers of the violations. These sanctions, the plan was that these sanctions would be swift, meaning they would happen right away when there was a violation, and certain, meaning they would really happen. So in other words, when a rule was broken, there would be quick consequences. But the consequences would not be prison. It would be things like counseling or written reprimand, restrictions on desired activities, community service, tighter curfews, weekend house arrest, or perhaps a so-called quick dip in jail, perhaps over a weekend. The whole idea was to try to not create a major disruption in the person's life. Another positive feature about this law is the language that includes, that indicates that when a sanction is imposed, the impact on the person's employment and on their family needs to be taken into account. So we were kind of excited about this law when it passed, but unfortunately to date we don't have a lot of good news to report. They have only started minimally implementing this. There are very few written rules about different kinds of sanctions or about training and better training for the corrections agents. And in fact, we were really disheartened to hear that recently a DOC regional chief described a 6 to 9 month prison revocation as a short-term sanction. And just another, well, a bit more of an update. This kind of ends it, but as I say, this is a bit out of date, so I just wanted to mention that last fall, for almost 6 months, the Wisconsin legislature did have a study committee that was focused on reducing recidivism and removing barriers to employment for people that were coming out of prison. And members of Wisdom and Expo, which is ex-prisoners organizing, made a presentation before this committee, and that included information on how they could cut down on the numbers of people that were going back by being revoked, how they could make reforms in the system. The Council Study Committee heard this information, but they did not. They acknowledged many of the concerns that Wisdom had identified, but they did not act boldly, which is what we were recommending that they do, and they ended up not calling for any specific legislative actions for reform. They did recommend increased funding for some programs that currently exist that have to do with preparation for employment and mental health issues, and they did request some standing legislative committees to review some of the current practices and laws that are currently on the books. But frankly, these recommendations were all pretty minimal in terms of their scope and impact. The one bright note in all of that is that I think with a push a lot from, there are some really good members on the committee. Evan Goyke is a very sympathetic to Moses's concerns, and Senator Lena Taylor out of Milwaukee. And they were pushing for the state, basically, to request technical assistance from an organization called the Justice Center. There's a Council on State Governments that has what's called a Justice Center. And this is an organization that is partly funded with federal dollars and partly funded by the Pew Charitable Trust. And they basically provide individuals that will work with the states in the United States and suggest policy reforms regarding their prison system. And actually, 8 years ago, Wisconsin did engage the consultation of this group, and they did come up with a lot of very good recommendations. Not very many of them were ended up coming to pass, but they at least did have them, did have them contracted. We can use all the help we can get in this department because recently a study was done looking at what are the kinds of reforms that are happening nationwide. And we again have the distinction of coming in dead last, in 50th place on our status in terms of the scope of our reforms. So we can only go up from here. So the good news is that this legislative council did meet again in, I guess, late January, and they did ask for a presentation by some representatives from this Justice Center. And my sense was that the co-chairs, which is Alberta Darling and Robert Hutton, which are both Republicans, seemed to be very interested in trying to get something going with a potential contracting with this service again to get some more help. So we'll see what happens here. So that ends the formal presentation. We'd now like to have some questions, and James and Frank are going to help with all of that. So, yes, we have. I think we have mics for people.
Well, one of. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, because I'm not. But thank you for having us. Thank you. Wisconsin does not have private prisons. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All the prisons in Wisconsin are under state control. And that's due to, well, we did have a governor who attempted to establish private prisons in the state of Wisconsin, but they ran into some issues with the Wisconsin Constitution that prevented them from doing that. They actually built the facility. It's in Stanley, Wisconsin. It's there. And it's falling apart. I know because I've been there. But no, Wisconsin does not have private prisons. But the private prison industry is booming. Their stock has just went up substantially coming out of our recent election. Because we again have someone who says he's a law and order president. We have issues that are going to be arising in our country concerning immigration. And so I foresee, the use of those facilities. You know, I think our numbers of incarceration in this nation is going to go up substantially. I hope that's not the case, but I think that's the outlook.
Good morning, Frank Davis. I am the community organizer from Moses. I'm also a board member for Expo, which is ex-prisoners organizing, and I am also previously incarcerated. However, me being previously incarcerated doesn't define me, and I make sure I live my life to make sure it doesn't define me. However, just to give you a short background, because my story can be long, whenever you're dealing with the system, as I have, James and a lot of other people, we have a story. Sometimes our stories, when we tell it to you, most people would shake their head and say, I can't believe it. Honestly, when I tell my story there, sometimes I say, I can't believe it. But just to give you a little background, born and raised in Kansas City, I came up to Wisconsin in 1986 when I was 16. 2 years after that, I wind up getting incarcerated and I went to prison. Now, the 2 years when I came up here, I was a 16-year-old trying to find my way. It is what it is. However, me going to prison, I accept my responsibility for what I did. However, the amount of time that I got and what happened after that, I don't necessarily think maybe was the best, but it turned out the best for me because I believe it changed me. I spent 20 years in prison. Well, 4 months short of 20 years, or 4 weeks short of 20 years, which is a month short of 20 years. So as my little joke, I always say I've been locked up for 20 years, and then when I say, ah, no, it really was 19 years and some months, you know, is my joke. But when I got out in 2007, I got out to a PO in an environment that did not embrace me. I was planning to go back to Missouri, where my family is. I had, after 20 years of being locked up, I had no family up here. I had no friends up here. I knew no one. I had everything set up that I set up on my own. I had two job interviews. I had an apartment lined up for me to move into. My brother-in-law had a car that he was going to let me get. And I even had a church home that I set up on my own. 3 weeks before I was to get released from prison, my social worker called me and told me, no, you have to stay here in Wisconsin. If you make it up here in Wisconsin for a year, then we let you go back home. I'm like, wait a minute, I don't have nothing set up. She was like, sorry, there's nothing we can do. So basically that set me up, and I tell you that to let you know that that set me up to let me know that the system was not for me. It was going to be against me. And so when I got out, well actually let me back up a little bit. The 3 weeks after I was told that I had to stay up here, I said, okay, I know that you are totally against me as a system, so I'm going to do everything I can to prove you wrong. So in 3 weeks, I was working as a law clerk in the library at Portage. I did everything I could to get every piece of information I could. I prepped myself, I prepared myself, and I got out saying that I'm going to disappoint everybody who do not believe in me. So when I got out, my second day out of prison, I got a job. And for the most part, other than getting laid off, which I had no control over, they laid everybody off. For the most part of getting laid off twice, I've had a job since I've been out. So for me, when I got out, I knew that I had to try to change the system somehow, some way. And fortunately, I was able to get involved with Moses, which was about 3 years ago that I got involved. I was an administrative assistant working with Moses. Prior to that, I was doing freelance writing. I was doing motivational speaking, and I was trying to get the word out there, trying to make some type of change. I was trying to find out where I fit in and trying to make that change. Fortunately, when Moses came along, it helped me get that position. But prior to that, I don't want to take up too much time. I had to deal with crime as revocation. And I'm going to tell you my story real quick, if I can. Crime as revocation, as it sits up there, when it's truly sending a person back to prison for committing no crime. At the time that I went back to prison, I had me a job working 40 hours a week. I was a freelance writer for a magazine and a newspaper. The guy who owned the newspaper was getting ready to start a magazine, and I was going to be running the magazine. So with basically what I was doing, I wasn't making a lot of money, but I was making roughly around about $50,000 a year. So take that number, bro. My $50,000 a year that I was making. Now take that number and say that they decided, because my ex-girlfriend, I broke up with my ex, she got mad, she called my PO and said, well, Frank Davis, he's doing this and this and this. It was lies. But they wound up locking me up. They did their investigation, and during the process of the investigation, they said, oh, well, you got this cell phone and this laptop. You didn't get prior permission to own it. There was nothing illegal on it. There was no porn. There was no any other things you could think of that could be illegal with the cell phone or the laptop. I just didn't get prior permission for the laptop and the cell phone. They sent me back to prison for 3 years. Okay. Actually, 32 months. I call it my sabbatical because they wind up helping me. But by me going back to prison, this is what they did. They took me away from my job. If it wasn't for my sister, I begged my sister to move up here because she had got laid off, and I said, I'm making enough money. Help me start this magazine. She moved up here. So if it wasn't for the fact that I had my sister to move into my apartment the day after I got locked up, I would have lost my apartment. I probably would have lost everything inside because I wouldn't have had no. And I just, and understand, I was locked up for 20 years. I had zero credit. At this point in time, I was doing so well that I walked into the bank asking for a $2,000 loan to get me a car, and they laughed at me and said, why do you want $2,000? I said, I need a car. And they was like, why don't you get more? I said, I can't. She was like, well, yes, you can. Your credit's like 700. It was like 720 something at the time. I didn't know I had worked my credit. That's how good I was doing. So I wound up getting a $10,000 loan. Walked into the bank, out, $10,000 loan. Guess what? When I went back to prison, I had to forfeit my loan, sell a car back to the bank, And I am in the process now, which has been about 3.5-4 years since I've been out, of trying to get my credit back to where it was. So that's sort of like, I went through it real fast, I won't take a lot of time, but that's sort of like a synopsis of my story and the situation that I've done. And real quickly, when I got out, they told me that because my sister maintained my apartment, they said, you can't go back to your apartment because we can't verify it. Well, my name is on the lease. The apartment managers wrote a letter to the parole board and everybody else on my behalf, but they said that when they called the property manager said they don't know me. I can actually, from jail, I could call the property manager and they accept my phone call. That's how close we were. But they said that they didn't know. So they told me I couldn't go back to my apartment. And then they gave me a list of 96 rules. Now the rules were so, one of the rules was if my curfew was 9 o'clock, I couldn't go on my balcony in my apartment or I would get locked up. I was violating my curfew. And I stayed on the second floor of an apartment building. I couldn't even go sit out on my balcony. I couldn't get a cat without permission. But she slipped that rule in there because my sister had a cat stay in my apartment and she didn't want me to go back there to try to justify me going to a halfway house. So that's sort of just to tell you, but I fought it. And when I got out, I went from having the 96 rules that they put on me to having like 30 rules, which would be normal, which is what I should have had. So that's just to let you know how there was no justification for the 96 rules. It was just because she wanted to do it. And so we have to fight this, and that's what we do. So that's sort of, you know, just to give you a little bit.
Okay. All right. I don't know how to do this. I'm a native of Saginaw, Michigan, and came to Wisconsin in the early 80s, 1981, 1982. Went into the Wisconsin prison system in 1983. Whole different system back there. Came home, and you can add this up, in 2007. 24 and a half years. Plus one technical crime is revocation because they revocated me and then they gave me a criminal charge after the fact for having a computer without my agent's permission and failing to register my email address with the Department of Corrections. So I ended up back in the prison system for another 22 months. My story. I went to the Wisconsin prison system as a young person. I had acquired a general education diploma that I had received while I was in the county jail in Michigan in 1977. While I was in the Wisconsin prison system, I earned my associate's degree. I became community communications director for a group called the African Culture Group. I eventually became the president of that organization. I used that position to reconnect with the community. I did fundraisers for battered women's shelters. I did fundraisers for America's Second Harvest. Started an independent business, the only person to be allowed to have a business in the Wisconsin prison system, to assist those in prison to have access to greeting cards and other things that would help them stay connected to their families so that men could be able to buy birthday cards for their children and other things like that. The reason I know about the private prison system, I bucked the system. I decided that what they wanted me to do, I wouldn't do. I wouldn't stay in prison to become a better criminal. I went to prison and became a better human being. So when they sent me to Tennessee, Corrections Corporation of America, I took advantage of that opportunity and established a lot of programs, worked with the community down there. So I built relationships while I was in the Wisconsin prison system. I built relationships outside the prison system. I brought attention to what was going on in the system, and that was a no-no. So sometimes I would go back to my cage, which people call the cell, and I'd find everything in disarray. I'd find my typewriter broken. Sometimes I'd find myself being told, oh, the project that you're going to be doing this week, you won't be doing because we're sending you to another facility. So I've been to almost every prison in the state of Wisconsin. Because I would upset somebody, they put the cuffs on me and shipped me out. So I got a lot of travel miles. Coming back to the community, I struggled. I struggled very hard. I couldn't find employment. I couldn't find housing. You know, for a lot of people and a lot of organizations that said that they were there to help and assist, they weren't there. I had one singular individual, a gentleman by the name of Clarence Thomas, who at that point in time was running Style and Grace Barbershop on the South Side. I was having a discussion with him one day, and he asked me, he said, "Young man, do you know anything about ceramics?" I said, "Yeah, man, I did ceramics while I was in prison." He said, "Do you want to have your own business?" I said, "Yes." He pulled the key out of his pocket and handed it to me. He said, "I have a shed out there full of ceramics, kilns, everything. Go to work." And I got busy. And then I got revocated. And lost it all. I entered into some business agreements with some people who had substance abuse issues and literally lost the opportunity at multi-million dollar businesses. So, after I got revocated the second time, I came out and I heard about this new organization that some friends of mine were in the process of building called Moses. And we started with like about six individuals. I remember when there was only six of us. And we sat down and we started talking about it and strategizing and saying, what is our purpose? What is our reason? One of the things that I think that, you know, let me get this out, where I think we've kind of fell short is that we haven't made a clear statement from our organization that we are not anti-victim. Because what I do is to prevent other victims. As a person who's been in prison and who has seen the result and the traumas of crime on community, we want it to be known that just as we support those who are incarcerated and transitioning to our communities, we also are here to support the victims. That's why I do what I do. Another reason I do what I do, you saw earlier, and that was the children who were sitting here. Because I don't want to see them fed into this vicious system, okay? And have their lives destroyed and their families' lives destroyed and then have our communities destroyed. That's why I do what I do, okay? So I'm here for this community. I'm here for Moses. I'm here for Expo. I speak at different forums. I go to Edgewood College. I speak to Moses. I help with the Madison Urban Ministries and training volunteers. I work with the university. And this is unusual. This is very unusual because I'm very transparent. And the Department of Corrections hates it. And I often say to them that I'm their best ally. Because it's not all of their rules and conditions of parole that prevent me from going out here and recommitting crimes. It's the faith and the support of the people in this community who I've bonded with and have relationships with and in many ways love and care about. That's the deterrent. You know, so each and every one of you who are sitting here this morning, you know, and whether you are part of Moses or not, but if you see individuals who you know who have been in jails or prisons and you still have that thing in you that says that is still a human being who has merely made a mistake or made a bad decision, but they still are a human being and they deserve our compassion and maybe even our forgiveness, then you are a part of Moses. You are a part of what our faith tells us who we are and what we are supposed to do. Too long, but that's it. So thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, everybody. Thank you to our speakers, and greet your neighbors, and consider what you will do with all the information you've gotten today.